Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Are You Not Kentertained? Today is August 15th, 2017. This is episode 68, and we are here to talk about Game of Thrones, episode 5. Chris is here, and on a really unrelated note, but this is how I want to kick it off, 14 years ago, Freddy vs. Jason came out in the movie theaters. I don't know why I remember that date and not the date of many of my friends' birthdays, but hey, some things in life are very important. Chris, how are you?
I would have been doing better if a certain thing hadn't happened on the episode yesterday and was going to force me to eat crow for the majority of this podcast. So other than that, I'm doing pretty good.
I mean, that almost makes it sound like I'd be like a vindictive person that would like bring up something like a lot, but I mean, I'm not Eric.
You know, I didn't notice it like twice just in the 9 questions you asked in the podcast or anything. So.
Oh, shit. It's good times, good times. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be getting to that later on, but what we're going to do is we're going to try to go through it chronologically as best as possible without leaping forward or backwards. And yeah, we'll get to that. Overall, another really solid episode. There hasn't even been like a medium level. I would say every episode has been 7 or higher on a scale of 1 to 10. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. You know, before this, I would have said that, you know, season 1 was a really good season, but I liked season 6 because of, you know, the fact that everything was new for me for the first time, and it was a lot of really high episodes. I'd say season 7 so far is setting the bar for all of the seasons.
Yeah, season 7's raising the bar for TV in general, and it's not necessarily fair because we know that things are going to be wrapping up, so we know that we knew in advance that we had 2 seasons, we had 13, 14 episodes, we knew that they were going to go balls out. With that being said, this is like, I don't even know like how a TV show is ever going to come close to touching this. It's going to be a while, I feel. So that's cool. With that being said, let's get on with the episode. Start off with Bronn and Jaime after Bronn saved Jaime. Hell, I don't even remember what the hell was said there. Was there a whole lot being said there?
Bronn called him a cunt, which I thought was pretty awesome.
They used cunt a lot in this show, especially the Hound, but Bronn as well, so that's always pleasing. Anything else?
One of the big things that we would have seen from that was the fact that Bronn was telling Jaime, yeah, I'm not preparing to be around there when, you know, she comes flying to King's Landing with her dragons.
Right.
In addition to, this is the first time we've seen, you know, somebody actually acknowledge that, holy shit, she's got 3 dragons, she's going to fuck us up. There's nothing we can do. We're not winning this war.
Yeah, basically Bronn was saying, you know, I'll stick by your side, but, you know, I can't help you against the fucking dragon. Which, yeah, that seems pretty fair, considering that Bronn did give the legitimate best shot that we've seen against the dragon with the scorpion, and that didn't do much of anything as far as we can tell. Moving on, we had the Danny being fucking Danny bullshit, and then demanding everybody bend at the knee because that's her fucking fetish of the season, apparently. Then Randall and Dickon, Tarly, all that stuff. Anything of interest here for you?
Well, I think it just goes to illustrate the hard choices that face people in this show, you know, in this world, for lack of a better term. I mean, like Tyrion in the next scene, or maybe it was 2 scenes later, argues with Varys, what else could she do? You know, she gave these guys an option that most lords wouldn't have given. They just would have fucking not even worried about going through and killing all the fucking non-noble soldiers. And she was defied by, you know, the 2 people in charge after giving them a choice and multiple times to recant. You know, she fed her baby.
All right. Now, I to play a little bit of devil's advocate here, really, did Randall, more so than Dickon, did Randall really have a choice? Like, if he bows at the knee, I feel like he's going to lose the respect of his soldiers, A. So that was kind of, I don't know, shitty from his perspective. And B, why does she all of a sudden get to be like, hey, I sentence you to death? Like, no, we can't just put him in chains or something, you know, put him as a prisoner. No, you just have to die because you don't agree with my way of thinking. Isn't Dany kind of being a bully at this point? Like, a sore sport that she got outsmarted by the Lannisters? Or am I overthinking it because I just have disdain for that lady?
I think you're overthinking it. But,
fair enough.
No, I mean, look at it this way. He was already sworn fealty to her through Olenna. So he's already risen up in betrayal against Daenerys. And now, if he said, okay, I'm sorry, I'll serve you. I mean, or, okay, I'll kneel, but you're going to put me in chains, but I'm going to escape and try to betray you again somewhere down the road. You know, what kind of options does she have at this point? He's already proven himself to be someone who's willing to betray his liege in order to advance himself.
That's a fair point. I'm hoping by the end of the season, some witty young whippersnapper on YouTube will come up with a music video with all the times of Dany asking people to bend at the knee, because you could make a long song from that. After that, we had a short scene with Jaime and Cersei. A lot of the scenes were short this week. There were a few longer ones, but a lot were smaller scenes that we'd come back to later in some capacity. With Jaime and Cersei, Cersei was pissed off about how Olenna was killed after Jaime revealed the death and everything. Was there anything else really to be gained about this particular conversation before we get to the latter one?
Well, it gave you a heads up into what was going to be coming on in one of the later scenes, in regards when, you know, Cersei was like, oh, fucking, you know, he killed our father, blah, blah. And she's like, no, Tyrion didn't. It was Olenna. And, it also, it was basically just, well, she still thinks that they can win or hold out or somehow. And Jaime's saying, yeah, no, there's no fucking way. You know, I saw what one dragon did, and she hasn't even brought the other two over to us yet.
Yeah, I mean, once again, we'll get back to that. Way down to number 12. So, once again, there was a lot of things that were, in the beginning, set up for scenes later on in the episode where a lot of times Game of Thrones will just give you, like, a large 8 to 10 minute chunk where everything kind of develops for those characters. In this particular episode, they started with the characters, went to other characters, and worked their way back. So this was kind of an interesting direction for an episode, I would say.
Not only that, my brother was talking about, I was talking with him yesterday, about like how they seem to finally have developed fast travel in Game of Thrones.
Oh my God, it's absurd, right?
So you can speed like 300 miles away in like 7 minutes. It was awesome.
And where the hell? All right.
Only Dany had that in like the first 4 seasons.
Yeah, maybe she would. Hey, I'm kind of mad at them, if only because first 3 episodes gave me so much to love about Euron, and I haven't seen him in 2 episodes, and I need more Euron, hopefully next episode. The dude's too entertaining, we have too few episodes remaining, I need every good laugh that I can get from that man. We moved on to Jon being able to touch Drogon, and then Dany asks about Jon's heart stabbing, because that's just a stupid subplot that apparently is bigger than I want to make it out to be, and Jorah returned. Let's talk about Jon and Drogon. Is this this more ammo for the three-headed dragon philosophy? Is that where you think it's heading, or is it more about Jon being half Targaryen?
That's a good question. I mean, it's one of those two things, which would seem to say that Tyrion, you know, like what people have been hypothesizing, or that Jaime, which is a new one I just fucking saw, and Cersei, probably aren't half Targaryen. Otherwise, Drogon might have possibly reacted like he did to Jon, rather than, you know, like, scaring the shit out of Tyrion like they did in whatever episode last season when he went down to feed them while she was gone.
Now, so, I want to ask, and you remember this better, did Tyrion actually touch the dragons when he freed them, or he just freed them without touching them? I couldn't quite remember.
I'm pretty sure he freed them without touching them because they were busy fucking shouting at him and possibly breathing fire. But it's been a while back, so I don't remember it, you know, per se, 100%. I couldn't find, you know, like a little clip of just that scene.
Okay. Go on.
That's pretty much it. I don't really think there's... I think it's either one of those two interpretations is basically what we get. Either he's something special, or he's something special because he's part Targaryen. We unfortunately don't necessarily have a third person to be able to throw up against this and see if it's, you know, because of the Targaryen blood or if it's because he's just Jon Snow.
You know, I mean, since you know, this is the week of celebration for me and wild theories that I kind of lost hope in, I'm going to get back on the mirror train and say that that bitch is the third head. Hey, stranger things have happened.
Yeah, it was season one last year and season two this year, but...
yeah. Can't wait for that. Speaking of which, Jim will not be doing a podcast with us, so we're going to look for somebody else to potentially do it with us. Jim has a busy, busy life, apparently. I thought the whole John Hart stabbing thing, like, they slid it in, I don't know, episode two, and it's been brought up like three times, I think. How is this going to come into play? Because clearly they're not letting that go, which means that it's coming into play. Is John going to get stabbed again? Do they want to learn about the Red Lady, Melisandre, like how she did it? Where do you think that particular part of the story is going?
There could be a lot of ways. I mean, you have Melisandre show up and she's like, oh, Daenerys, you're so amazing, but this guy Jon Snow, he's pretty badass too, and he's coming to meet you. I did some shit with him, but I'm not going to tell you anything about it. You'll just have to see for yourself. I'll make him take his shirt off so you can see the scar over his heart. So I think she's wondering from that, and then, you know, like, that's kind of like a weird saying, you know, you took a knife to the heart for your people. It's not like, you know, something that I would consider, you know, like...
It's not like you took one for the team.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like that. It's a little further than taking one for the team, you know.
Right. And Jorah returned, looking dapper as ever. And, I mean, anybody that's been listening to us knows that we're both fans of Jorah.
That was one of my favorite scenes in the show. And pardon me for interrupting, but I read this review of the episode as I was getting prepped for this. And I was laughing my ass off because they're like, Jorah comes back and he sees Danny and John next to Drogon and he's all happy, and then he looks over and he looks at John and there's like a look of acceptance and resignation, and he's like, okay, this guy's good looking and he's a king and he's down here with Danny, and John just looks back at him like, oh, it's sunny out.
Yep, pretty much like Jorah has gotten that look down to perfection of, really? I missed the boat again. Like, he has that whole thing down pat, and...
I'm pretty sure John has the whole look down pat of, you know nothing, Jon Snow. He's like, yeah, you're right.
Oh, gosh. I hope to see more of those two interacting, if possible. I don't know. The whole thing's interesting to me. Next up, we had like probably a minute or two scene of Bran, the ravens, and seeing the army, Winter. What was to be gained? Like, it seems like the Night King already knows, like, he's being watched. So, I don't know. Was there a rhyme and reason for this particular scene from your perspective?
Well, A, it's to show us why Bran calls himself the Three-Eyed Raven, you know, because now, you know, just to answer back to last week, we actually finally see him possessing ravens. I think it might be to show the various levels of power in a particular way without being like really overt in stating that. But like, if you remember, the previous Three-Eyed Raven, every time he was appearing to Bran or seemed to be spying on anybody, it was within the one bird. Here, Bran's got a whole flock, and he's sending them, you know, to watch the Night King. And as soon as the Night King realizes Bran's there, he's able to just snuff the whole thing out. So I think that might be a little subtle way of kind of saying, hey, yeah, Bran's becoming more powerful than the guy his predecessor was, but at the same time, within his sphere of influence, the Night King is more powerful than Bran. So Bran's not going to be able to just be this get-out-of-jail-free card down the road, guys.
That was the one thing I kind of got out of it, was that probably the writers and stuff were like, yeah, everybody's expecting Bran to be like this overpowered character, which he is to an extent, but they still had kind of put him like in his place a little bit. I do have two follow-up questions that you may or may not be able to answer. I'm guessing may not, but still going to ask. One, in the books, did they allude to Bran like just having extra power? Like, I mean, is he fucking Luke Skywalker where he can just get this shit down, like, is better, like, the best ever? Or is there anything to really base his level on, aside from what we saw with the previous Three-Eyed Raven?
No, there's nothing really to base it on, because we're, with the Bran storyline, we're way past where the books were. Like, it ended with him just getting there, none of his training, none of the going back in time to see, you know, his dad fight Arthur Dayne at the Tower of Dawn. None of him seeing, you know, Hodor as a young kid. So all of that was brand new. So We've never actually seen an indication of Bran actually use his powers, anything beyond warging into Summer or warging into Hodor that one time in the tower when the wildlings were almost getting them back, you know, like what, season 3?
Yeah, geez, it was either 3 or 4. Might have been 4. I don't know. Yeah, it's someplace in there. I also got a thing, like, it is such a shame that nobody on YouTube, once again, didn't make, like, when Bran was training, why didn't they make a video of that set to You're the Best Around from Karate Kid? Come on, that video should be made, and I would enjoy it. I'd watch it at least 20 times. My second question is in regards to the Night King. Do the books indicate anything about like all of his powers? I mean, he's still like an unknown quantity.
We've never even seen him in the books. Oh, he might not even exist in George. The only one that we've seen in actuality in the books was the one that Sam killed in when he was fleeing with Gilly. Other than that, you've never even seen a White Walker. Oh, you've seen a whole bunch of the Whites, you know, like during the Fist of the First Men, and when the dude attacked them in Castle Black in the first season. But you might have seen one for briefly when Craster had the son, when they first went up north of the Wall, and he put him out for sacrifice. I think John might have seen a White Walker taking him. But you know, Hardhome was a completely made-up episode, so you never had that thing with, you know, John going to try to get the wildlings who went back north of the Wall to come south to be saved. You know, in the books, when they invaded and they lost, they were, you know, basically kept penned by Stannis' forces down south of the Wall until John ends up making them his offer. Potentially, the Night King might not even exist in the books that haven't been written yet, or he could exist exactly as he is. You know, the whole story of like the Children of the Forest making the others so that they could have somebody protect them from the depredations of humanity. That might be true. That might be just for the show. Who the fuck knows?
Huh. I'm very interested to know the powers of the Night King, and yet simultaneously, I want to thank the writers and stuff for not giving it away quite yet. There's no sense in giving it away until they need to give it away, is the point. So I'm very much looking forward to that. Moving on, we had the Maesters having their meeting, Samwell talking to them about Bran, Maesters being very dismissive towards Sam. I mean, obviously it led to... We may as well just combine this with Sam also riding off after getting some books and scrolls and stuff. Let's just combine this into one conversation.
Yeah, there are basically three Sam scenes this week, and they all fell relatively close to each other within the timeline of the show, so...
Yeah, do you think... Obviously, I think a lot of people watching it think it's Sam's best choice because we have this... You know, 10 episode timeline now. So we know that there's an urgency versus if we knew there was four more seasons to go, we may not all be in agreement that was a good decision. What do you think he's going to find in the scrolls that he picked out? Like, he seemed to pick out very particular things.
Good question. The way I see it, Sam's basically got like three things going forward, and I think I touched upon this in the blog when you asked this question. One, do you remember, this is a question for you, Kent. Do you remember when John sent Sam to go become the Maester? Did he have to renounce the Black, or was he still considered a member of the Night's Watch?
I thought he was still considered a member of the Night's Watch. Like, wasn't he going to be training to be the Maester for the Night's Watch?
Yeah, that's what I thought, but I didn't remember for sure. But as it is, I mean, Sam's already blown off a whole bunch of his vows by, like, sleeping with Gilly, probably, you know, multiple yeah. times for, like, the last, you know, two seasons or whatever. In addition, you know, I don't know, stealing a sword from his dad and all sorts of shit. So, potentially you have here's Sam, who now could end up being, you know, Lord of Highgarden, maybe, potentially down the road, since he's now the only Tarly left alive.
Ooh, I hadn't thought about that. That's nice.
Yeah, so... There, he could end up potentially siding with either side. I mean, I would see him staying with John, but at the same time, you have Daenerys who just roasted his brother and his father alive. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's a lot at play.
Yeah. There's it could potentially go a lot of different ways with that in regards to Sam. On the other hand, now that I've seen that pretty much, unless King's Landing is got a whole bunch of those scorpions. Hidden away, and they all hit this dragon at the same time. I'm pretty sure that if a dragon dies, it's going to be to the Night King. So when he starts flying around on his dragon, you know, next season to rain, I guess, ice down on the people of Westeros, what's in the books might be, like, the only thing that can help them in regards to that shit. You know, I managed to grab the one scroll that has the way to destroy the One Ring and the fires of Mount Doom kind of bullshit.
Yeah, like, I mean, he grabbed maybe one millionth of the fucking possible knowledge inside that library, but we all have a general idea that whatever it is they did grab is going to be the quote-unquote key to some victory, it would seem.
Yeah, exactly. So, there could be that. And then there's also the fact that he's full of, you know, knowledge now that nobody else has, but which changes the whole political landscape of the Seven Kingdoms, you know, if it comes out, so.
I'll ask two more questions, because Sam's an interesting character, and I like reading about him, and two things have come up. So I'll ask one at a time here. In your opinion, is Sam the least likely member of the show to die? Because I've heard that from numerous people, and I kind of agree with that.
I would like to say yes, because again, I do like his character. I do like the actor a lot, too. And the dude plays D&D in real life, so that gets two thumbs up for me. Yeah, he's almost, again, with the name, but he's almost like the Samwise of the show. You know, the guy who, you know, just through being a good guy, not necessarily through intelligence, although Sam has this, whereas, like, Samwise really didn't, but through perseverance and his heart and his dedication to his friends, you know, he shows that not everybody has to give up, or, you know, that not everybody has to give in. He's one of the only people who's taken, like, a moral stance and stuck with it. You know, now that I think about it, he might have been one of those people who should have been put up for that question, you know, next to Littlefinger as one of the best manipulators within the show. So, thinking back to, like, how he got Jon elected to Captain of the Night's Watch. Well, you know, this guy's going to vote for him, but, you know, if you vote for John, then he won't get the votes, you know, blah, blah, blah. So.
You always have time to update your answer or add multiple things. basically what I got from this, and this is a shout out to my wrestling stuff at ninedeuce.com/wrestling. Chris basically just told us that Samwell is the John Cena of Game of Thrones, and I'm completely behind that. Also, his Lady Gilly, she is very attractive in real life. With that being said, I had a second question about Sam, which is eluding me at this very moment. This sucks.
I mean, that's another thing I'll bring up to talk, to give you a chance to try to get your mind back on. But I mean, like, at this point in the show, he's raising, you know, a ignorant wildling's child by incest as his own, you know, with, you know, no compunctions about it. So, I mean, that's just another example of how he's just, you know, a straight up good guy in this fucking shitty world.
All right. Yeah, I agree with you. And I remembered the question now. Not only do a lot of people suspect that Sam is probably the most bulletproof of the characters, there's been some debate over who actually is more important to the final war against Winter. Is it Bran or is it Samwell? Like, it's all speculation because we haven't seen the war. We do know what Bran can do. He may be able to do more stuff that we don't know, but we don't know what Sam will find out. In the end, who do you think... We know both will be important. Do you think one will be the final thing, though? Do you think one guy will be the thing that ends the war?
I don't know. I mean, either one potentially could be. But the way I would look at it would be like this. Like, if Bran died right now, what could Sam do to replace him? You know.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, if Sam dies, Bran could potentially have gone in and seen everything that Sam saw, you know, through Sam's eyes while he was doing it, so he could potentially have the knowledge still. On the other hand, after the war with the Night King and the White Walkers and the undead is over, what's Bran going to do? I mean, he could say, yeah, Jon was a Targaryen, blah, blah, blah. But really, what's the Three-Eyed Raven going to do? Probably go head back north of the Wall and send his tree?
Well, that's the hope.
And now, with what's gone on, you know, and the potentialities of what's sitting around, you know, Sam could have multiple roles afterwards. So, in that case, I think he's more likely to see the end of the series, but is he necessarily going to be the one who single-handedly saves the war? I don't know about that, but he's definitely an important character and definitely a fan favorite, I think.
Oh, yeah, both are fan favorites. I think people are drooling in anticipation of the power of Bran, what he'll unleash. And Bran is the epitome of potential. Like, he has all the potential in the world to be the game changer in this Game of Thrones. Whereas, well,
I guess now, if we're talking about the three heads of the dragon, and we only have two people to actually ride the dragon, Bran could potentially be warged into the third dragon, so...
Yeah, I've read probably about 20 different names of people that could potentially be in it, some a lot more likely than others, but... As you said, I mean, you mentioned Jaime earlier, and it's like, yeah, there are some theories out there with some sound ideology behind it, so it's a cool mystery that I hope we don't even find out till next season. I like these surprises.
I mean, at this point, too, people are so into just trying to fucking figure it out and be different that they're just fucking tossing names out of a hat and being like, Bran the Builder, he was alive 2,000 years ago, he could be the third head of the dragon. You know, kind of bullshit. You know, Azor Ahai.
Oh yeah, there's more honor in people's mind of tossing out a random name and trying to prove it rather than going the safe route, because you don't get any attention that way, and people are attention hungry. So, you know, I'll use Walking Dead. Before we knew whose head got bashed in by Negan's bat, pretty much everybody in the lineup had a video or 500 on YouTube about how they could potentially be the victim, because people want to be like, hey, it was me, I'm the one that predicted it right, just in case.
But wasn't that relatively a little bit easier, though, because there was only, what, 8 people in the lineup? 9 people in the lineup, something
there
like
was,
that?
there was 11 people, and we all knew Glenn got it in the comics. That was a well-known thing, and it was also known that
they had the fake out with him before that shit.
Yeah, they had tons of fake outs, and in the comics, two issues prior, so issue 98, Abe had gotten killed. So we knew that stuff going in. It was just a question of, were they going to stick with tradition, or were they going to try to... you know how some shows try to surprise people without logic versus just telling the logical story? That was the big fear, but they did a good job with what they did. Despite killing fan favorites, it was the smart thing to do. Moving back to Game of Thrones, we had the Varys and Tyrion discussion, which you kind of already alluded to, where they're both like not trying to take the blame off themselves. They tried to stop powerful people from doing things that they may not agree with. I found this conversation to possibly be the second best conversation in the whole, or maybe third, second or third best conversation in the whole episode. Did you get anything of value from this?
I don't think this is really one of the ones that's going to have a lot of repercussions. I think this is basically just what it was on the surface. A scene between two people, trying to justify her behavior compared to her parents. And two people who were disturbed by the fact that they weren't able to influence somebody to take a lesser of two evils, I guess, or not excise the brutality that they had the option to. One of the things I want to say, though, is, like, how many great lines did this fucking episode have? Like, just all over the place.
Every 5 minutes or so, there was good lines. I mean, of course we were going to get... Between Varys and Tyrion, I think it's pretty well known that those are two of the top 5 to 10 talkers in the whole show. So when you get those two in a room in a conversation, you're going to have something quality. So the lines, though, yeah, there was a ton of great lines. You're right.
Yeah, that we'll definitely have to go through at the end of this and just pick out some of our favorites. But, I like the way that Varys was talking about, for what was it? And I heard their screams, as they burned or whatever. He kept repeating it, they would do this, and then I heard the screams, I heard their screams. So whatever the fucking case was with the line, I thought that was an effective use of alliteration and what, onomatopoeia.
Yes. I would love, I know they've alluded enough to it where we're probably never going to get anything beyond what they've already given us, but there's a part of me, I would love to just have a full episode. Obviously they won't give it, but like a full episode of Varys from his childhood and like all the shit that he's seen up to this point, because he has seen more shit in his role even as a kid and everything. Like, he has seen so many ridiculous things. He's such a fascinating character, and unfortunately we get to know bits and pieces but not the full story. And that's if I could go to one character, he would probably be the character I'd love to see his whole story arc, really. After that, we had 6 people in the room. We had Dany, Tyrion, Varys, Davos, Jon, Jorah, all discussing this plan to bring the dead to Cersei. Good idea, bad idea, don't know, don't care. What are you thinking here?
Well... I'm almost of the opinion, especially because they can fast travel now, that they should have put this on hold, taken out Cersei. Definitely that. I mean, at this point, Dany straight up said, if Cersei's not around, I'll fucking help you fly my dragons up and burn your army of dead people. So, focus on one enemy at a time. This just smacks to me like a stupid fucking idea. Not because it's necessarily a stupid idea from their point of view, but because they're actually, like, trusting Cersei to not betray the fuck out of them. If you know what I'm saying. Although, it's a good idea from showing us a lot of the fan things that we're looking for, because this right here is straight up fucking leading to Clegane Bowl down the road, so.
Yes, it is. You know, this kind of reminds me of, and I'm trying to think of a reference that more people would get, but I'm just going to use the cartoon Justice League because I didn't read the comics or anything. But like every like season, there'd be like one major bad guy that was so badass that, you know, the Justice League would team up with Lex Luthor and his bad guys, and they'd all work together, finally take down this big enemy, and then Lex Luthor would immediately betray the good guys, and we'd be back to them fussing in a feud. And that's kind of what I'm seeing here. It intrigues me. Like, I wonder if they're really going to go down that route, because it made more sense, as you said, for Dani to just get the fucking Iron Throne and be done with it. It doesn't seem like she's 95% of the way there. Like, there's not much left to go. Just finish it. It's intriguing. It's definitely intriguing. I don't know. I'm very curious where it happens.
It gives us one of the coolest setups. It brings back one of your favorite characters and makes me fucking eat my words from the last 3 weeks. But I think in hindsight, we're all going to look at this and be like, whoever dies next week, this was all a result of a stupid decision. Whoever dies in the last episode of the season is an all a result of this stupid decision. I don't know. I mean, she could cause some shit, but, like, if... At this point, they have to be like, if what John is saying is true, this is the end of the human race, but we're going to worry about, you know, the 15,000 people that Cersei could potentially bring from King's Landing with Euron, and worry about dealing with her and getting her on our side to believe it, to call an armistice. Yeah, I'm just like, just deal with the fucking situation right now. Bam, puts a bitch out of the power.
Yeah, it seemed like almost a treading water decision. That's the best thing I could really think of. It's like they're just trying to tread water with this idea instead of going full out. But this is also the setup to... I mean, with 9 episodes remaining, fan favorites are going to start dying.
What would have been easier... for them, I think, so much easier would have been like, hey, why don't we go kidnap my brother Jamie, show him a fucking White Walker, and have him convince Cersei. Said, no, let's bring a White Walker down from the north to, you know, show Cersei in the middle of all of her power and court and everything.
The whole idea seemed absurd. Like, yes, I 100% agree. If they would have captured Jamie and Bronn, so we get Bronn some more screen time... as we're both fans of, you know, capture him, bring him up north, show him some White Walker. I mean, if Cersei won't take Jaime's word, nothing will get her fucking attention at this point, which some may say she's too far gone, who knows, but it's interesting, and I agree with you. I agree with what you're saying on that. Moving on, we had this... we had Sansa with, like, a town hall meeting, for lack of a better term. And then, you know, people were fucking upset. Bitchy, bitchy, bitchy. Then Arya and Sansa were up in their parents' old, you know, bedroom or whatever. Arya called out Sansa for liking nice things, not defending Jon. Blah, blah, blah. You know, we may as well also tie this in, because there's no other real segue to... Arya and Littlefinger and the scroll. So let's discuss all of that. What are your thoughts on how Sansa's handling things, first and foremost?
Well, A, these scenes illustrate the biggest difference between the two Stark daughters now, in that one of them has grown up for the last several years and has developed physical abilities beyond, you know, most people, changing faces, you know, as a little kid, able to fight Brienne of Tarth, Tarth, wherever the fuck she's from.
Tarth, you're right.
Yeah, to a fucking standstill, you know, when this is a chick who fucking beat the Hound. Able to walk in and assassinate all of the Freys at once, which is pretty fucking badass still. Compared to B, someone who's been victimized, brutalized, and yet has been able to learn how to be manipulative and political and play the game. I mean, if anything, I think this episode shows, in regard to Sansa, is that she's not necessarily looking to become, you know, Queen of the North, Queen of the Seven Kingdoms. But the temptation is there, like Arya was saying. But, you know, if she was looking to betray Jon, I think she would have been playing the game more with the Lords rather than, you know, Jon is our, you know, our king, we have to follow his orders, blah, 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 kind of shit. I don't remember what the exact words were within that scene. Whereas Arya, not having really gone through this whole political maturation that Sansa has, is just seeing, oh, you didn't stick up for our brother. They'll fucking cut their heads off. They won't talk shit anymore after that. You know, she basically is still of the mind that, you know, Joffrey was able to take power doing this. Joffrey fucking killed our dad doing this. You know, fucking be like Joffrey kind of bullshit. So we'll see. And I mean, it also shows that Arya was younger. Arya, you know, felt betrayed by Sansa with all of the interactions that happened between her and Joffrey and, you know, the Lannisters and the Starks before, you know, their dad died. And so she still hasn't completely forgiven Sansa for this shit, whereas I think Sansa's just happy to have her sister back until she starts acting like a fucking prick, for lack of a better term. But, oh, you always like nice things. You used to make it hard for everybody without it, kind of shit. So, leading into the whole Arya and Littlefinger thing, it really makes me wonder if he realizes that, like, he's on her list of fucking names, so...
Yeah, I mean, to go back to the whole Sansa and Arya thing, like, I love how... I mean, granted, we saw it right from the get-go, the differences between Sansa and Arya. We got it, even when they were kids, there was a huge gap in philosophies and their mentality and how they think. And, you know, seven seasons later, we're still seeing how that played out, where Sansa is the more diplomatic, whatever you want to call it. Have you considered, or do you think that there's anything in Sansa that's, like, jealous in the fact that of all of her living siblings, including Jon, they all kind of have, like, a special ability? You know, Bran can warg, Arya can do the whole fucking faceless man bit. Jon came back from the dead. Like, do you think Sansa at any point is like, well, where the fuck's my special power? Where's my green ring?
Not only that, but I think the fact that, you know, she's been raped, she's been abused, she's been tortured. I think she's like, you know, other than she knows that Jon died, Bran broke his back, you know, before all this shit really kicked off. But she's like, these guys all have special powers and none of them had to suffer for it. Whereas, you know, I fucking suffered, you know, years and years and years of my life over the last couple of seasons and, what's coming to me? But, yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. I don't think that, like, she would necessarily, for lack of a better term, you know, pick up the one ring, you know, and put it on in order to gain power. But at this point, you know, I think if it was, like, the choice was let Littlefinger rape me or fucking betray my family, I think it would definitely come to betray my family before, you know, that kind of shit.
Yeah, she's kind of hit that point. I've been saying this all season, but to me, Sansa's by far the most interesting character in so many ways on the show because of the multitude of ways that she can still, you know, go. Like, she's a wild card in the fact that we know where she's been and how she's gotten there, but we don't know at some point what's going to push her over the edge or anything. Like, she's definitely a wild card, and I really like her character. Definitely I think she's got to be my favorite female character of the season so far. That or Cersei, I don't know.
I mean, there's a lot of ways that you can look at most of these characters, you know, extrapolate from what we've seen in the last five episodes and predict where they're going for at least the next two. Maybe not the next season after that, but, you know, where they're going to be at the end of this season. And Sansa's just one that, you know, I think there's just way too many outcomes, ways that she could possibly go to be able to say, okay, well, this is definitely for sure the one area that she's going to, you know, the one path that she's going to go down. She's just got too many, you know, everybody's coming to, like, a fork in the roads, or maybe they're coming to like a four-way intersection. She's coming to like a traffic circle with like 18 different fucking branches leading out. It looks like a fucking octopus or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of variables with her, and it's incredibly exciting to me to see where she goes from here. Regarding Littlefinger and Arya, I like the fact that Littlefinger played his little game. Was it you or was it Jim? I want to say last week that had the whole idea that Littlefinger may be sending a message to Cersei. Do you remember? In the blog?
It was Jim. He thinks she's going to be sending one. And I almost wouldn't put it past him if he hadn't betrayed her a couple times.
Well, that's why I was going to ask. Like, do you think there's... I liked the idea. I just didn't see the practicality of it. But I did like the idea. I thought it was a good idea.
I think he's smart enough to realize that Cersei's one of the people who wouldn't, like, oh, Littlefinger, you betrayed me so many times, but now that you've given me this one piece of information, I'm going to welcome you back into the fold. Why don't you come down to the Sept of Baelor and we'll have a good time? You know, we'll drink, have a couple drinks, you know, we'll talk about the good old days kind of bullshit. Yeah, I don't think he would fall for that.
I agree. I mean, really, think about from the first few seasons, there was always these people in power that Littlefinger could play, and now it's getting down to Cersei he can't fuck around with, Daenerys would never tolerate that shit, Jon sure as shit won't tolerate that shit, like, Sansa's onto his game, he's running out of people to manipulate, it, and yet, I still feel that he has something left to offer of value, that like one last fuckery at the very least. I'm hoping.
What if Littlefinger has been in touch with Euron?
Oh, that's a good question. How accessible would boats be to Winterfell?
Well, I mean, they were able to get there season two when Theon fucking invaded.
Oh, plus everybody has a portal gun. Let's not forget the portal gun.
But what I'm almost thinking is, like, what if he was somehow... I mean, Euron wants to marry Cersei, but what if, you know, Littlefinger was like, hey, dude, fuck Cersei, I'll put you on the throne.
I would love that. Once again, it'd be the combination of two characters that I hold in such high regard that I'd be 100% for it, even if somebody has to get got. I'm okay with it. I mean, I like that idea.
At this point, there's not that many people that I could see coming in, flying in from out of nowhere to ally with him to really give him a shot of... So if Sansa doesn't go with him, I really don't see too many other people that he could be appealing to or who would be willing to betray, you know, whoever they've allied themselves with to side with him against their former allies.
How big of a... I mean, alright, let's go with percentage here. Based on all the soldiers right now up in Winterfell, like, what percentage of that would be from the Vale? Like, represented the Vale, would you guesstimate?
At this point, maybe half.
So, I mean, he still has that last card where he can manipulate Robin. I'm still hold on to the thought that he's going to manipulate Robin at some point, and I kind of want to see Lady Mormont bitch slap Robin and just humiliate him. That's something I'm really looking forward to and hoping beyond hope that it happens.
That would be pretty awesome.
Like, let's face it, she's become not like the most beloved main character, but out of any like side character, she is by far the most beloved character out there, I think, at this point. For somebody who has had, what, less than 10 minutes of screen time?
Pretty beloved. I mean, when you got fucking balls, you got balls. She's got balls.
Gosh, I hope, you know, once again, something that will probably never happen, but, you know, if there was, like, ever, like, an epilogue to this whole Game of Thrones, and she was somehow on the Iron Throne, I don't think anybody would remotely question that decision. It'd be fucking fascinating to me.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would either.
Alright, now we have, the Tyrion, Bronn, and Jaime meeting. Bronn somehow set up the meeting, and we got to see three guys that we all like to see together on the same screen. Anything? I mean, obviously Cersei brought it up later, so I would say let's talk about this, and also we can talk about the Jaime and Cersei part two, because they kind of connect a lot. What's to be taken from the meeting between the brothers, first and foremost?
Jaime's still pissed. Tyrion is, glad he's still alive, but he wasn't able to fucking talk him into, forgiving him for killing Daddy. Other than that, I think it wasn't too much of a major thing. I think a lot of the more important King's Landing stuff happened in a second. It does set us up for the second Jaime Cersei scene, though, and I think that is more important because that establishes that Cersei has a better idea of what's going on than everybody's been giving her credit for. B, she says that she's pregnant with Jaime's kid and she's going to name him as the father, and they're going to be happy and forever in La La Land, because who's going to fucking say no to the queen? And C, then she proceeds to tell him never to betray her again or else. And, he gives the kind of look that makes me think his life is coming in episode numbers rather than in season numbers now. So,
yeah, Jaime's like in the worst, one of the worst spots, because he's in so deep, but he knows that his time is, his days are numbered, obviously. One thing I did want to ask you, and maybe this they went over this better in the books, it struck me, at least from the TV show, that Tywin favored Cersei over Jaime, and obviously over Tyrion. Tyrion's not even the discussion. Did Tywin favor Cersei in the books?
He really favored none of his kids. He fucked them all in different ways. Like, he just hated Tyrion. Cersei was mind-fucked all over the place. Jaime, he was dismissive of, because he never ended up gaining the glory that he was supposed to be the best swordsman in all the Seven Kingdoms, but the only thing deed he had listed under his name in the Kingsguard book was that he killed the Mad King by stabbing him in the back. So, Tywin was basically, like, the worst parent ever, and, that pretty much shows in, like, how his kids are the worst royals ever.
One may argue that Stannis's wife is also up there in worst parent in the show.
Stannis might also be up there, but that's like one fucked up decision versus, a lifetime of fucked up decisions that is now having repercussions for the entire Seven Kingdoms.
Sure. All right, so the pregnancy. I think the pregnancy is a big story, because there's nothing concrete about it. Whether she's pregnant or not, we don't know. Who she's pregnant by, we don't know. Will she actually get to deliver the baby? We don't know. So let's break those three things down. A, do you think she's pregnant?
I'm giving it a 50-50 right now. It came just kind of out of the blue. Like, almost to the point where it's like, oh, you're talking with our brother who I hate. Oh, look, I'm pregnant. At the same time, I'm pretty sure that if it was anybody's baby, it would be Jaime's, because he's the only one we've actually seen Cersei having relationships with. Whereas in the past, there was Lancel, there was whoever the fuck else there was.
Didn't it almost seem to you like, once she revealed that, I immediately was like, well, why the hell didn't you guys have a scene setting up Euron trying to get in Cersei's pants, like, in a more intimate setting, so there'd be questions? Like, I felt that was a missed opportunity for them not to at least get us wondering, hey, could it possibly be Euron?
Yeah, exactly. Like, if they came in and said, oh, well, it's Euron's now, I'd been like, what the fuck? There'd be no prior... they've only seen each other in the throne room twice, unless he's fucking able to impregnate her from, like, 6 feet away, which would be, like, one of the coolest superpowers in the Seven Kingdoms. I just don't see it happening. Whereas, if there was at least some kind of doubt, that would make it... I think it would have made it a stronger revelation, too, and given more credence to the fact that there might be a baby than, her just being, oh, like, hey, I'm pregnant. But admittedly, last week we did have the blowjob and the whole sex scene between the two of them, so.
Oh, yeah. That we did. Good times. Good times. Finally, if you had to put a percent, do you think Cersei's baby's ever going to see the light of day?
No. I don't think it's going to make it. Let's put it like this. If it sees the light of day, I pretty much see Cersei as being the one who's sitting on there and thrown at the end of the series. So.
And wouldn't that be... That would be something fascinating. I mean, it would upset a lot of fans. But man, would that... I would love to find out, like, at the end, like... I wish this was almost a last season had, like, a choose-your-own-adventure, who-sits-on-the-Iron-Throne at the end type thing. And, like, have it be a DVD or Blu-ray special feature where they, like, say, hey, this happened, this happened, this happened, and boom, that's why they're on the Iron Throne. I would love to see that. I don't know. I'm going to say that she's not pregnant. I think that was... We see this in modern society where sometimes a woman uses that as a way to mindfuck a dude. And now is not the time to be mindfucking Jamie, but she seems to be deeming this a really good time to mindfuck Jamie. So I don't know. I feel that it's almost a fake out.
I wouldn't be putting it past her to be putting a strap on and just fucking Jamie at the same time that she's mindfucking him with this shit going on.
That is, we have yet to see a strap-on in the show, so fingers crossed.
We have. And we have. Little, you don't remember the one that Joffrey used on the, had, what's-her-face used on the horse?
Oh, shit. Yes. My bad. My bad. I of all people should have remembered something of that nature, but I dropped the ball. Ah, fantastic. All right. So, let's... move on to Davos and Tyrion. You know, they showed up and Davos went to, what was it, Flea Bottom?
Yep.
And there was that moment. There was that moment where it was probably a good 20 seconds before you saw his face, but I felt the anticipation. I think a lot of people hopefully felt the anticipation. People who know me did.
Can I describe yesterday morning for you for my...
Oh, please do enlighten us all.
I've just gotten off of work. My wife was watching Ballers, so I had to sit for the half hour of her watching that to be able to watch Game of Thrones. My son's first day of school, so we get him ready. He's out on the front porch waiting for the bus with my wife. And I can see them through the window just sitting there, you know, talking a couple minutes while they're waiting. And it gets to the part where Davos is going to Flea Bottom, and I see him go to the Street of the Smiths. And I'm like, motherfucker! God damn it. God, she's like, what? I'm like, now I'm going to have to fucking eat shit in front of Kent for all the stuff I said for the last 3 weeks. She's like, oh. I was like, yeah, that was it. That was it. So
she completely dismissed you, like, really? That's all you're going on about?
Well, I mean, she heard me outside, and I was still inside, but I thought that was funny. So.
Yes. So, yes, ladies and gentlemen, for weeks now, we've been talking about Gendry, and Chris had kind of walked me off the edge a little bit. Really did a good job convincing me that to just give up hope. And the weird thing is, I got a message, because I was like 10 minutes behind, I got a message from my wife saying, okay, there you go, boom. And I was like, oh shit, somebody just died. I'm not expecting anything. I'm so oblivious to the situation, and that... Like I said, you know, as soon as you know that he's on that particular path, you're like, oh, no shit. So, yeah, I even, like, paused the episode, took a few deep breaths, possibly may have smiled for the first time in 12 years or something. It was a good time. With that being said, even though you were wrong, you're happy, right? Like, this is cool. Like, they made Gendry cool as shit, right?
Yeah, no, it was definitely... You know, the rumor I had heard before this, and which is why I was dismissing it, was because they're like, oh, well, now that they have all this dragon glass to, and they're going to need to turn into weapons, they're going to bring Gendry back, and he's going to be the blacksmith. I'm like, he's a blacksmith, but he's not like Robert Downey Jr. I mean, he's not going to be Iron Manning the shit out of, like, thousands of weapons at a time.
Yeah, he wasn't like this world-renowned blacksmith with like huge nade attached.
He was good. I mean, his shit stood out, and that was how Ned was able to pick him out the first time he went to see him. But he wasn't like, he's not like at a production, you know, at an assembly line. He's not going to be industrial revolutionizing the fucking blacksmith trade. But the way they used him and the way they're using him, at least in the next episode, good show, good call, good call. I really like the scene further on when he and John finally meet. I'll wait till we get to that part, but, you know, just lots of fucking good lines in this episode. Oh, I thought you'd still be rowing.
Yes, like, all right, so that whole conversation was great between Davos and him, and then...
So I want you to come with me. It's going to be... All right, let's go. It's going to be... What?
No, I'm ready. I've been ready. I've been waiting for this moment. Let's just go. Then the guard stopped me. He's like, I'm here with Clovis. And I was like, what a great name, Clovis. What the fuck?
That reminded me of, like, so I just finished watching the Devil's Rejects and House of... I was like, that name should have been in fucking there. Clovis should have been one of the fucking family.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That would have fitted well. And... I mean, let's say how awesome his fucking battle hammer is. That's a pretty badass looking weapon.
I like the way that Jim describes him as Thor in the Winter Avengers.
Oh, I haven't read anybody's responses. I don't read anything until like Wednesday or usually Thursday, probably. So I don't read anything. So good to know that compared him to Thor. Like, as happy as I was, the scene afterward, they're by the boat, and then, you know, he tries paying them off, and then he has the fucking... He gives them a fermented crab, and then hurry to your favorite establishment before you put a hole in your chainmail. That was my favorite line of the whole episode.
I really like that line, but then I started thinking, and I'm like, chainmail is just basically full of holes. So I
mean. It is, which, like, yeah, it's not like a flat piece of metal for people who may not know what chainmail is, but still, it's a hilarious line. Oh, God. That's so good. Moving on, we had Jaime and Cersei. We went over that. So this leads us to Jon and Gendry meeting, and Davos has already told them, you know, this is your name. You're not to mention who you are. And then Gendry's just like,
"Oh, nope. Right. He's really stressed out. There's a lot of things going on. We don't really need your real name showing up and making it complicated. So you're Clovis, right? Or blacksmith. All right. Right. Yeah. Hi, I'm Gendry Baratheon, and I'm Robert's bastard son. Our dads knew each other."
Like, it was so, like, probably my eyes came out a little bit because I was like, I did not really expect that, but it was so, it made so much sense because he knew he had a connection with John on a level because of their bastard fathers. I loved it. Who else was it? Was it just those three, right?
Yeah, just the three of them.
Okay. And then after that, I mean, they got along great. I liked their dialogue back and forth. Then we got Tyrion and Jorah having a quick talk about the coin, and then Jorah had his farewell to Dany for probably like the 17th time in this series.
Oh, we should be getting better at it by now.
Yeah.
Damn right, you should be.
Anything to be made from the coin? Was that just like a, hey, does anybody remember this particular scene, or do you think there's anything more to it?
I think it's just an example of the fact that Tyrion actually likes Jorah and considers him a friend. You know, the coin was only from when they, you know, talked their way out of dying as slaves in Meereen before they, you know, hooked up with Dany again. Yeah, so, I mean, you had that, and you had the whole fucking Dany fluttering her eyelashes at Jon. Oh, but I've grown accustomed to the King in the North. Bullshit. So.
yes. I'm sitting there like, who's cock blocking who right now? Because it's definitely what stood out to me was the cock blocking happening because, you know, Jorah's still hoping against hope, and John's just fucking oblivious as fuck most of the time.
He's like, yeah, okay, it was nice to meet you. Bye. I gotta go get a White Walker. Hold on.
Right, like, she could have been nude in front of him, like, directing, like, her hand signs down to her crotch, and John would be like, yeah, I gotta go practice my swordsmanship, I'll catch you later. John is just that John's the epitome of like the oblivious teenage boy that does not pick up on a single sign from a chick, which is great. Like it makes him relatable to at least the male demographic. I think the women also can relate because they've dealt with boys that were like that. So it's part of his charm.
If he was arrogant and he was like, oh yeah, I'm good looking as fuck, kind of like Rob had been, it would have been a different story. But the fact that he's clueless to the shit almost makes it endearing about him.
Yes, I agree. Back to, because after that we had the Sam and Gilly where they had the talk before, you know, they were, Sam's just like, I'm packing shit up. Gilly was referring to Rhaegar getting his annulment before he hooked up with Lyanna, correct?
Yeah, basically, she just dropped the biggest bombshell in the fucking episode. In that,
and Sam didn't pay attention, right?
Sam wasn't paying attention because he was fed up with the 15,000 shits. No steps.
that was such a good line, too.
That, it was, that he missed it, the fact that John is actually, if that's the case, and it's true, the rightful heir to the throne. If you go by the fact that the Targaryens, you know, being deposed for being insane and murdering, burninating the shit out of people was a bad thing.
Yeah, I've kind of, after realizing so many facts, I'm like, I can't even wrap my head around the continuity of who's technically the rightful person on the throne anymore, because it's confusing when you really think about, well, whose rights outdo who else's rights. Like, it's very confusing, but I like all the possibilities of it. But Sam just being so just blind to it cracked me up. And Gilly steals every scene that she's in, I feel. Like, she makes the most of her time on screen, it feels to me.
Yeah, she does a good job.
Absolutely. I really like her.
For a character that could have been just a throwaway character, yeah, she does a really good job with playing, you know, her ignorance and lack of manners in society and her transition into the person that she's becoming up. She does a really good job.
I mean, I loved her when Sam brought her to his father's, you know, fucking castle or whatever. Like, she was so good in that particular, you know, scene or scenes. She's really, really something special. Then we talked about Arya already with Littlefinger, and then we're off to Eastwatch, the namesake of the episode. And finally, we get an update on the Hound. We get to see Tormund, who's asking about, I believe he said the big lady or big woman.
The big woman. Did you bring the big
fucking
woman?
Fucking hilarious. Yeah. Everybody kind of like pairing off, being pissed off at somebody else in the room, which also was pretty good.
Let me interrupt for just a second. Wasn't Eastwatch just one of the coolest looking areas that they fucking filmed in too so far?
Absolutely. Really? Yeah.
The way they had the fucking cliff edge and then it's built out onto the little one fucking promontory. I thought that was really cool looking. You know, when they was like, well, what are we really looking at when they were showing the map at the beginning, but when they finally showed it and you saw the actual physicality of the way they had filmed it, it was like, wow, that's fucking badass.
Have they always shown Eastwatch on the map in the opening?
Nope, this is the first time we've ever seen it.
Okay, I can't ever remember because of my memory, so I was like, it's a good question. Alright, that's cool then. Lots of good stuff here, lots of good dialogue. I mean, all I said, here's what I thought of, and I think you'll appreciate this. Like, if they could just take those guys and remake John Carpenter's The Thing, I would love it.
That would be cool. I was getting like, I'm like, wow, this is like such a fucking Dirty Dozen vibe I'm getting going on right now. Or, you know, like something like Stalag 13, you know. I was like, well, this is fucking pretty badass.
It was by far the biggest. All right, I mean, for characters, it was the biggest grouping of badass dudes that the series has shown ever, as far as I'm concerned. It's just amazing. But I do have a couple of questions. Of course I have questions. Did you watch through to see the preview for next episode?
Yeah, I actually just watched it a little while ago, so I saw the preview.
All right, so they show, who is it, Thoros or Dondarrion with the flaming sword?
All right.
Dundarian, right?
Yeah, Dundarian is the one with the one eye and not the top knot. And he's the one who sets his sword on fire in the preview.
Now, isn't the flaming sword supposed to be something significant? Like, isn't that supposed to tie in with Azor Ahai, or am I getting my facts mixed up here?
No, he's supposed to Azor Ahai is supposed to reforge Lightbringer, which was the sword that he used to slay the others back in the day. The flaming sword was something that Thoros of Myr did all the way back in the first season when he was fighting in the tournament that Loras ended up winning, and then the mountain killed his horse and the hound came out. And,
mountain. Good for him.
The hound came out and saved Loras, and that was why, you know, he split the championship between Loras and the hound. But that was basically like, this is like a spell that the Red Priests have been able to do, and maybe Dondarrion can do now. I mean, the whole thing with the magic sword and why people are now saying Jaime is the prince who was promised is because when he was creating the sword in the original legend, he worked on it for 20 days and 20 nights, and he took it out and he tried to use it, and it broke right away. So he worked on it for 30 days and 30 nights, and he quenched it in the heart of a lion, and he tried to use it, and it broke right away. So then he worked on it for 50 days and 50 nights. He called his wife in, quenched it, and by killing her with it, and it sucked her soul into the blade, and that was why he was able to kill the others. So now they're saying, oh, well, Jaime's going to sacrifice Tyrion as the Lannister. You know, that's going to be the lion. And then he's going to kill Cersei, and that's going to be the wife that he sucks into it, and then he's going to be able to go around and kill the others. Who the fuck knows? There's been so many different ways that you can apply it to Danny, to fucking John. To whoever. You know, the only
there
thing we know for certain is
that
it's supposed to be
there.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a Targaryen descendant who is to be the Azor Ahai. So,
yeah, I mean, hell, I've heard that it was Tyrion. I've heard that it was Mira, which, god damn it, you know what? I'm going to go on bold prediction 2. And hope that at least something's good with Mira. Like, I feel Mira's story has not been fulfilled yet, so I'm hoping that she has a bigger role, either as part Targaryen, or something. Hopefully something cool with her. If you had to just make your best educated guess on who you think the show is going to reveal as Azor Ahai, not going to hold you to it, obviously, because it's ridiculous to hold anybody to this, but, like, Who do you think it will be, and who would you like it to be? Because that could be two different people.
I don't know. I mean, if you go by the fact that it's got to be a Targaryen descendant, we only know three for certain at the moment, so that puts it at either Gendry, Jon, or Dany. You know, there could be possibilities for it to be somebody else, like one of the Lannister children, although I would really doubt Jaime and Cersei, because those two actually looked like Lannisters. The whole reason that Tywin thought that Tyrion might not have been his was because he had the dark hair, he didn't have the tall, you know, the height, the blonde hair, the thinness, all that shit. So if that's the case, you know, who the fuck knows? Could be Mira. God damn it, I would hate that. I would have to eat crow to my dad for years worth of fucking talking shit now. So.
Gosh, this would not be your season then at this point. I think at the end of the day, I feel that John and Danny are the two obvious choices, and this show doesn't always want to go with obvious. And they've given those two characters so much shine, it feels like they want to give the shine to somebody else.
Like the prophecy, the whole thing says that Azor Ahai will be reborn in fire. We'll create dragons from stone, and we'll reforge the sword Lightbringer out of flame. You know, something like that. Those are like the three key things. So, you know, I'll go on record as saying that whoever fucking pulls the sword Lightbringer out of fucking their ass is going to be Azor Ahai, because at this point, you know, John and Danny both could have been seen to be reborn. Danny's really the only one who has the dragons out of stone, anything going on with her right now. So, you know, that third piece of the prophecy is going to be the big key. Who the fuck knows? Maybe it could refer to a combination of, like, five or six people. And, you know, all of the shit that they have to do together means they have to work together in order to overcome the shit.
Like a Justice League.
Yeah. Yeah, there you
hey,
go.
Hey, second reference.
Yay.
Or like G.I. Joe. I'm going
to be like knowing is all the battle.
I'm going to say that I think it's Gendry. I'm hoping it's Mira. Now that I have proof that he's back, I feel that he's had a bigger purpose all along. So that's why I say that. But it'd be cool if Mira. If Mira has a big part, I don't care if she's Azor Ahai or not. I just kind of want to see her story more. She has a cool little story, I feel. So, next week, we know that we're going to see our guys going out on a venture. I'm going to say it's 98% likely that one of those guys, at the very least, is not coming back. Would you say that's fair? And if so, who do you pick out of that group that may not make it back?
Well, all right. So this is what we got going out. We got Jon going. We got Gendry going. Tormund. Jorah. Beric. Thoros. Sandor. And a bunch of nameless extras who were fucking carrying shit on sleds for him.
Is Davos staying back?
Davos is staying back. Cause there's that one line where he's like, I'm not going to be any good to you out there. And Tormund looks at him and is like, yeah, we know.
Yes. Tormund definitely gets probably facial expression of the week for me. For between that and the big woman.
Did you bring the big woman? So we're pretty sure that Jon's going to live. We can be pretty sure the Hound's going to live. Otherwise, they're denying us Clegane Bowl, which is going to be fucking sad.
I would riot.
Unless you have Zombie Hound go up against Zombie Mountain, which actually that could be cool too. But I don't see them killing Tormund off. Although he could be gotten, but like I think the fans clamoring to see him and Brienne get together is going to be enough to save him. Same thing like Gendry just came back. I don't see them bringing him back just to kill him the very next episode up in the north. So I think that means that Beric Dondarrion and Thoros of Myr are in the fucking crosshairs for next episode. In which case, like, I think some of the people were suggesting in the blog, they could be passing their Red Priest powers / Lord of Light powers over to Sandor, which could then make sense as to give him, you know, some way to stand up against his brother when he finally faces him in combat down the road, so...
Yeah, I would say... alright, so... Thoros is the one that resurrects Dondarrion. That's correct?
Yeah.
I always get these two. Okay.
Yeah, Thoros is the one with the top knot, the cunt with the top knot, who resurrects Dondarrion. Dondarrion's got the one eye and the beard, and now it looks like he's going to be setting a sword on fire, too, so...
I'm going to go... I think Dondarrion makes the most sense, but I'm also going to say... if I had to do top three, I would say Dondarrion. I would say Tormund, because even if they give us the Brienne and Tormund thing, it's not going to be a huge story. Like it's going to be sad for fans, but it's not going to have a huge impact, really.
Well, the only other thing I would say that would keep Tormund alive would be the fact that they really haven't identified another wildling to work with Jon. And since the wildlings now are pretty much half of his forces in the north, you know, they don't really have another general. It'd be like, oh, well, you know, because it's not like Dorne, where, you know, the Dornish could be out of the story entirely and it's not going to matter. I mean, straight up, the Army of the Dead is coming right at the wildlings. So without somebody else to interface with them and Jon, you know, if there's going to be a battle at Eastwatch, it would make sense for Tormund to still be there, at least for that name recognition between, you know, fans who they've seen and, you know, okay, we're not just bringing some nameless fucking wildling in to be the new leader, you know, kind of bullshit.
For that reason, I thought it was a mistake when they did it during the Battle of the Bastards. I don't think they should have killed that giant, because the fans really liked that giant, and he could have been either good as the guy that died during this trek, or he had enough face value where he could have taken over the army.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have worked.
It was a mistake to kill him.
It might not have worked because he couldn't really speak, you know, like Westerosi or English, but other than that, it would have worked. He definitely could have been the sacrifice for this next episode coming up.
And it would have been terrifying, you know, the fucking...
All of a sudden, you know, he dies, and then all of a sudden he gets up and starts running after them, too. Yeah.
Right, that's terrifying. What about Jorah? Jorah's just off the table, do you think? Or?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, like, it would... I don't think Jorah's going to live to see the end. I think he's definitely going to sacrifice himself to save his Khaleesi. But,
it's got to be in her presence when he dies. Like, exactly. He has to die for her.
Exactly.
Right.
Or, you know, like, on a mission for her, or in front of her, or saving her life, rather than helping Jon Snow out up in the north.
Yeah, at first I thought Jorah, and I was like, no, Jorah's whole storyline, the end of that rainbow has to be...
Plus, he hasn't seen his niece yet.
Oh. Oh, I could really go for that scene.
Yeah. Now, what the fuck is this traitor doing down here?
Yeah, she'd be pretty pissed off at him, right?
Yeah, she's, you know, he was supposed to take the black for selling slaves, and he ended up fucking fleeing the whole country to go work with their enemies overseas.
Yeah, so, all right, I'm 100% behind that idea. Jeez, that was horrible. Will we get... Theon and Euron next week.
You know what? That could fucking tie in with the whole bringing the White to King's Landing and complicate the shit out of things in the last episode of the season.
I've been wondering if they're holding on to that for the finale of this season. It'd be a longtime character in Theon that everybody knows and possibly hates, and Euron is one of the most charismatic characters we've ever seen. So, I predicted that this week we'd get it, and now that I'm thinking that they're holding off till the finale.
Yeah, I have a feeling because just based on the way that they've set up the seasons to go, the way that, you know, it has over the since what season one and well season three did season three ended with the Reigns of Castamere. Or was that the penultimate estimate episode two?
It's usually episode nine. It's usually the penultimate episode where there's the big thing.
Because we had the Battle for the Wall, second to last episode. We had the Battle of the Bastards, second to the last episode. We had, I forgot what it was in season five, but same thing. And, you know, season five was what? The fucking showdown in the Marine Arena? That was the second to last episode. So I have a feeling...
Blackwater, right?
Blackwater. I have a feeling that this is going to be... The majority of the episode is going to be the trek north, because that's where we're probably going to be seeing, in addition to the fight with Daenerys, the dragon, the Dothraki, and Jaime's guys last episode, and Euron's forces and Yara and Theon's in what, the second episode? Or is that the first episode? Whichever case, I think this is where the majority of the special effects are going to be spent for this season. So I have a feeling it's going to be a good... We'll see little pieces of other shit going on, but the majority of it's going to be what's going on north of the Wall.
Which is something... now with, like, Blackwater, in the Battle for the Wall, I believe the whole episode was devoted to just that.
Yeah,
whereas
literally, it was the whole episode just for that.
Battle of the Bastards, they did a first half where they continued a lot of storylines, and then they saved the last half for it. And... I'm not saying one's better than the other. I liked how they did both of them. I think at the end, maybe not at the end, but at some point in the episode, we're going to see Theon. We're going to see the setup to the Theon and Euron showdown for the finale. That would make the most sense.
Well, we know there's at least one scene with Dany and Tyrion in the Dragonstone conference room, throne room, whatever you want to call it.
Correct.
So we know Theon made it back last week, and he just didn't get a chance to talk to Dany. So, at least that we saw. So he's there. The possibility for the setup is there for asking her for assistance in rescuing his sister. Again, we don't know where the fuck Euron is or where he's got Yara hidden. But I would imagine that if Cersei's planning something, and you know she is, she's got to be planning. She's got to be like, this is the perfect setup for the Sept of Baelor part two, where I blow the fuck out of everybody who fucking makes my life miserable. So he's probably got to be in on it somehow, since he's got to be 50% of her forces at this point, if not more.
Do you think the Theon storyline could tie in with getting Grey Worm some more screen time? Like, maybe he has the Unsullied as his backup for this mission? Do you think that's a possibility, by any chance?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely could be. Like you said, we've got a lot of fucking dangling fucking threads for just two episodes left in this season. So, potentially, what we might see is everything north of the Wall next episode, and then nothing with those characters until next season. And if they do, like, the longest episode being episode one, next season again, we could have a whole fucking shitload of things going on episode one to catch us up with all of the characters again. And again, the last episode could then pick up with the Theon and Yara and Euron shit, the what's going on with Greyjoy over in Casterly Rock, although, you know, fast travel makes it really easy for him to get back to Dragonstone, so...
Thank God for fast travel. Yeah, there's. I think the season finale is probably going to be at least an hour 10. That'd be my best guess, is that they're going to get at least 10, 15 more minutes. That'd be the hope.
Yeah.
All right. So we've got, you know, all of that stuff out of the way. Before we wrap up, we usually talk a little bit about horror movies.
Oh, before we get to horror movies, I think there's a couple other quotes I wanted to hit because they were just fucking awesome.
Oh, yeah. Hit your quotes, dude.
Like, fucking Davos said, hey, just fucking ignore me. What did I do? Didn't do anything other than live to a fucking ripe old age.
Yes, he was like such a bitter, sarcastic ass there.
I was like, that's me. And then, again, I think we already hit this one, but did you bring the giant woman? One of my favorites. So.
That's got to be a meme already. Like, that has to be a GIF or a meme or something out there online, because that was too fucking funny.
Yeah, I mean, there was just lots of really good fucking quotes throughout the whole fucking episode. You know, it was just, like, really, really quotable, highly memeable. I'm not really good with Photoshop, though, so...
Yeah, me neither. I think this is definitely Davos' season for the quotes. Pretty much every episode, he's had at least one good quote.
They were doing a thing on... maybe Conan or one of the shows before the season started, and they were asking all the characters who are still alive. They're like, if there was any character that you could kill in Game of Thrones, who would it be? And, you know, people were going around, and certain people had their answers. Jon Snow's like, well, Jon Snow secretly, or Kit Harington was like, Jon Snow secretly hates Brienne of Tarth, so he would kill her in a heartbeat. but they get to Liam Cunningham, and they're asking, and he's like, well, if Davos saw her riding down the street with her horse, and he saw the red cape, he's like, I'm pretty sure he would stop and pull out his Glock and just end the bitch. So I was
like, yeah, that's great.
He's pretty funny in real life, too. So.
And we have will we see Melisandre again the rest of this season, or do you think they're kind of holding off on her because she has a bigger role for next season?
At this point, I'm almost thinking we'll see her next season when she comes into resurrect somebody important and then die. Yeah. Because she's old.
Yeah, I feel that, like, she wasn't very needed this particular season, but they did enough between her and Varys, that conversation two episodes ago, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that was enough for her. And it sucks because I liked her character a lot, but there wasn't much for her to do this season.
Most of the time when you're watching shows like this, you're like, all right, 10 episodes. Yeah, it's not a lot of episodes, but there's still scenes that are filler scenes that you could probably have gotten rid of. This season, it's like, God, it's not enough. There are fucking all these scenes that should be in there that they just don't have enough time to, because you cut it by fucking 3 hours.
Yeah, I mean, realistically analyzing this, and the more I talk to people about it, the biggest thing is, the biggest threat to the show right now isn't, like, winter's coming and all this stuff. It's the fact that we know an exact amount of episodes remaining to fulfill telling the rest of the story. And with every episode that passes, as satisfied as we are, we're left with you know, one fewer hour to fulfill this huge story.
Because think about it, like, if they wrap up next season at the last episode, how pissed is everybody going to be to not see what happens after? I almost feel like the last episode of the season is going to have to be almost like a fucking epilogue, you know, episode where it just shows, you know,
yes,
10 years down the road or 5 years down the road or a fucking whole season, you know, compared, you know, season in the Westerosi tradition down the road.
You know, maybe Richard Dreyfuss could narrate it?
When spring comes, yes. So, who the fuck knows? But I'm like, if that's the case, that means we really only have 7 episodes left total, and then one to explain what everything that's going to happen afterwards.
Yeah, and I mean, once again, I feel shortchanged, but I'd rather have the epilogue episode than to just have, like, blue balls after the last episode. I'd much rather have some kind of explanation at
that,
the end.
That, like, as much as I like say, 6 Feet Under, you know, like, doing the ending credits in the last episode, you know, where, like, Claire's driving away and she sees all of her family, you know, dying in the later on as portions of their life, you know, basically all the important characters as they die. That wouldn't fucking work. I mean, there's so many fucking characters in this show, it would take, like, fucking 45 minutes to do that kind of fucking montage.
By the way, people, spoiler alerts.
Oh, well, I mean, at this point, six Feet Under has been off the air
been
for
around.
What, like 7 years, 8 years now? If you didn't know, the show's over. They all die. Sorry.
I did not know this.
Well, they all die. The epilogue extends for over, like, 50 years, to, you know, from she ends the show in her 20s and she dies when she's in her 70s. So it's a montage of, like, 50 years in a matter of minutes.
I don't mind spoilers because I don't remember them. And the only thing that the only spoiler that I really wish I didn't know was how Sopranos ended. But simultaneously, it's like, well, it's so ambiguous you can make of it whatever you wanted, which was their game plan. If I ever do get around to watching Sopranos, I know how it's going to end. And that, I don't think that changes anything for me. So I'm okay with that. It was kind of like, you know, watching Breaking Bad. I mean, you have an idea of where this is going to end up by the end of it. Or same with Sons of Anarchy. Same with damn near every fucking show out there. You have a general idea of how it's going to end. I can say with a show called The Leftovers, I had no freaking clue that's how they were going to end it. And I can say that I was completely and utterly disappointed.
Season to season, that show had no idea how it was going to end.
Exactly. Did you watch the whole thing?
I watched most of season one. It wasn't, like, something that was really my style. It sounded like season two and season three would have interested me more, but my wife was really into it, and she explained to me what happened, and I was like, it was almost like, sounds like an almost like a completely different fucking show, season to season.
Season three was just fucking disappointing, and, like, I kept holding out because season two kind of started off a little slow, but then, like, it picked up steam and got better, just like season one did, in my opinion. But then season three just never picked it up, and then at the end it was like, why did you choose to end it this way versus a show like The Nick, where they only had 2 seasons, and they fucking blew everything fucking up by the end. Like, it was crazy. Whether I agreed with it or not, it was crazy.
Wasn't Damon Lindelof one of the lead writers for The Leftovers?
I cannot confirm nor deny that.
I think he was, and he was also one of the lead writers for Lost, so that should
be an
idea of exactly why, you know, it ended the way it did.
I know Lost and Leftovers had some, at least one or two key writers, so yes, I can confirm that one. So, I never watched Lost. I kind of get past the first episode.
I watched all the first 3 seasons. After that, I started getting out because my work schedule conflicted with when the show was on, and Krista didn't want to watch it with me, so that kills a lot of shows for me right there.
Now
it's not so bad because there's so many different ways to stream stuff or to view stuff after live, but, you know, when that was on back in, what, 2004, 2005, you didn't have all of the streaming services that we do now.
Correct.
So that made it hard to watch. And but yeah, like, from what everything I understand, that same kind of fizz with the ending, you know, you have such a good show leading up to it, and then the ending fucking sucks, and it ruins the show for a lot of people, because that's the last taste you get of it before it's over. That's the thing you're going to remember about the show. You know, and you have something like that fucking ruin it for you right at the very end. Kind of like Dexter's ending, you know. Potential.
I didn't watch the ending, so do not spoil.
All right, I won't spoil that one. Although, I mean, there's a potential of them actually bringing the Dexter show back. At least they've talked about it, so knock on wood.
Are you more of a fan of an open-ended, ambiguous ending that's kind of a little bit more open to seeing how the characters potentially play out moving forward? Or do you like your finales with that sense of finality? Like, they wrap up every single possible loose end without any mystique left.
If it's like a mystery, I would prefer to have the answers answered rather than left open. Unless they're going to do something like Twin Peaks, where they come back, you know, 20 years later and actually maybe attempt to answer some of the things that they left open. But if it's something where there's a little ambiguity built right into it and they want to leave you guessing, hey, that works for me. Like, I look at like the ending of Inception is almost perfect. I mean, it ends and it lets you read how you want to read, you know, what's going on, whether he's still trapped in a dream or whether he's actually made it out of being trapped where you thought he was and he's actually in reality and he's going to see his kids for the first time. I think if they had gone like another 5 seconds longer with the top spinning around and you had seen whether it actually fell over or whether it steadied itself and continued going on, that would have ruined it. It would have said one way or the other. And instead you're left with, hey, it's open up to my interpretation. But, you know, that's over the course of, you know, a 1-2.5 hour movie. When you have a series, you know, that goes years and years and years, and especially ones where they try to build up mysteries and subplots around characters, and, you know, you want to see resolution for those characters that you've come to care about. You want to see them having character growth and, you know, answers to the dilemmas that they've gone through, and, you know, just the finality. You know, you're not getting any more of this. If you've actually enjoyed it and you invested part of your life in this time and this effort into watching it, you want to feel like it was worth something rather than, you know, getting to the end of Seinfeld and you're like, what the fuck is this shit?
Yeah, I mean, look at Firefly. People were not happy that it just ended, and people are still outraged, blah, 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 even though they gave us the fucking movie Serenity. I mean, what's done is done. I do have to say, though, my disappointment for you mentioning Inception, because that's easily one of the top 5 most disappointing films so far for me. Possibly in my life.
That's like in one of my top 3 favorite movies ever, so we'll have to agree to disagree. Yeah.
See, like, I, without burying the film, I will say that I am a huge fan of Christopher Nolan, and Memento, obviously, was my first experience. The Batman movies were a fine trilogy, you know, for comic books, you know, very good. The Prestige... I'm so excited. That was the worst part. Without critiquing the film, I was disappointed because it had a great cast and everything, and the movie just... It really bored me to death. And, like, it wasn't like Avatar. Avatar just pissed me off because it had a lot of hype, and I was like, yeah, I get it. There's lots of pretty colors. Not a great story. With Inception, it was more... I love the director so much. It had a great cast, and then to be just disappointed by the story... I was like, God damn it. But I own it, because I have a Christopher Nolan Blu-ray set, so that came with it.
Yeah, I actually have Insomnia, The Prestige, and Inception on the shelf right next to me right now. So.
Oh, yeah, I have... Insomnia came in it. Prestige did not come in that package, but I bought The Prestige aside from that. The only one I don't have from that whole era was... I think it was called Following. It was like his first feature-length one.
Yeah.
I don't think I had any stars, but it used to be on Netflix a lot.
It was like Pi was with Darren Aronofsky, where there wasn't really any stars, but you know, it was such a good movie that it kicked off their career basically.
We talked about him last week, right? Because he's the one doing Mother.
Yeah, which looks interesting.
Yeah, and oddly enough, the very next day after I talked to you about it, Camera. I talked to somebody else, and they're like, "Hey, have you seen the preview for Mother?" And I was like, "No shit." It was just kind of cool timing. Yeah, Darren Aronofsky. There's another good dude who, when he hits it right, he is one of the three best currently going today, in my opinion. When he does it right.
Yeah.
I would say that for him. I would say that for Nolan. I don't even know. Probably Tarantino. That would probably be my top three. When they do it right and just hit everything, it's hard to say anything else. Like, those guys are it. For me.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to agree. I fucking love Tarantino. I love Christopher Nolan. I liked some of Aronofsky's stuff. Some of his stuff I haven't liked, but I don't take
what,
it away
what
from
What have
it.
You seen that you didn't like? Because I'm not sure.
I wasn't a big Black Swan fan. You know, not as compared to... Like, I know a lot of guys liked it because of, like, the lesbian scenes, but...
But that's typical guy response
It didn't
right?
do it for me comparatively to, like, just some other movie. But again, that was one that I saw after the hype rather than before the hype. So the hype might have actually killed it for me.
Thank you for mentioning that. People still to this day don't understand why I won't watch certain movies because I'm like, it's been hyped to death. There's no possible way this film can live up to the hype. I have to wait a long time before I can actually watch it and see if I can find joy in it because right now it is hyped too much. Like, you're bound to be disappointed. People don't get that. They're like, well, just try to enjoy the movie. I can't. It's been too hyped up. Like, I feel there's a year. There's a year window. You know, it comes out in theater, then you get like 6 months, then it comes out on Blu-ray, DVD, all that shit. If you haven't watched it within a year of its release and it's been hyped, like, it's tough to kind of go back and not have expectations.
Speaking of hype, when we transition into the, which I'm sure we're doing, into the horror portion of this, yeah, the hype definitely is going to factor into some of the stuff that we just watched in the blog, so.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I mean, let's just transition to it.
That's fine. Fine with me.
As a matter of fact, tomorrow or probably Thursday, because I'm just lazy. I'm burnt out. In all fairness, for the few people that are actually listening,
yeah,
I'm burnt out.
You need to get rid of it now before you hit October, so.
I'm just burnt out in general. Like, when Game of Thrones finally ends, in September, I'm just taking like a 2 week fucking hiatus away from everything because I need it before October comes. Like, October is my winter is coming type thing. I'm just mentally burned out. So maybe a day or two. But speaking of hype, as Chris alluded to, House of 1,000 Corpses was Rob Zombie's first big feature-length film. Had all this hype of, you know, they had to release it unrated because they had to cut out so much crazy shit. And there's a lot of hype to it. And when all is said and done, I would say a lot of critics said that it was very similar to Texas Chainsaw Massacre with a Rob Zombie flavor to it. And it wasn't as widely praised as the hype allowed it to be. It wasn't bad. It was disappointing because of the hype. I know you had you had your experience with it. So, you know, tell us how you felt for the first time you saw it, and now that you've rewatched it, tell us what you think.
All right. So the first time I watched it, I was like, "What the fuck is this bullshit?" And I didn't like it enough to even bother remembering very much. I just remembered Fishman and Tiny. Like, those were the two things that I really fucking remembered. And I was like, I remember, like, Otis being like, who the fuck is this guy? This guy's a fucking retard. And I was honestly surprised when, like, years later I watched Repo, the Genetic Opera, and I'm like, holy shit, the fucking dude who played Otis is singing in the fucking opera. But, yeah, I realized that a lot of it was hype, and a lot of it was where I was at in the time. So I was, you know, when these got voted in, I was like, okay, let me go in with a fresh mind, and we'll see, you know, if distance has changed my opinion of the movie at all, and, you know, if time and, you know, just being in a different place in my life. And no, it's fucking a shitty movie, hands down. I was like, wow, this is even worse now than it was back then.
So it's still shitty.
I was so surprised, you know, and I was looking at it and I'm like, I don't understand what they took out, because there's really not a lot of gore in the movie. There's not a lot of, you don't really see a lot of the violence. You see some of the after effects, but it's not in your face with a lot of the shit like you see in movies nowadays. Or even some back in the day, like, you know, Henry Portrait of the Serial Killer, what have you. There isn't, like, a huge number of fatalities. And, like, as I'm watching it, I'm wondering about, like, a lot of the effects choices that he was making, you know, like, cutting to the psychedelic, like blacklight shots. I was like, what the hell is this doing? It's not telling the story in a different way. It's just fucking showing me that Rob Zombie was probably fucking high when he was filming it. So then we got into the second half, The Devil's Rejects, which I had never bothered to watch the first time because, yeah, I had been so disappointed by House of a Thousand Corpses. And I was actually surprised at, like, what a decent movie that was. I was like,
what? You feel that he got, like, you mentioned the editing, and I agree with you. Do you feel that he got, like, all that shit kind of out of his system during House, and then, like, Devil's Rejects, like, he kind of got his head more wrapped around, like, his job?
I do, and yet I don't, because hearing some of the reviews that his later shit has gotten, it almost seems like he just fell right back into that after The Devil's Rejects.
31, he reverted so badly. Ugh, but go on, please.
But yeah, it was like, there was cinematography, there was a plot, there was a story, the characters were still unlikable, and I mean, I don't understand what the purpose was in trying to almost make you feel sympathetic towards the family. When, I mean, these people are fucking mass murderers, serial killers, fucking possibly Satanists from some of the shit that was going on in House. You know, did they deserve justice? Yeah, they probably just deserved to be killed. I mean, did they deserve, you know, William Forsythe hunting him down? Yeah, it was.
Put yourself in his shoes, though, and you can see how it'd be a little bit more warranted, in my opinion.
But yeah, it was like, wow, you know, like, you know, like, people had character that they didn't really have in the first one. You know, they weren't, like, Otis wasn't flip-flopping back and forth between trying to be, like, Marilyn Manson, or is he a cannibal, or is he a Satanist, or what the fuck's going on with this guy. You know, it was just, like, a decent movie. The soundtrack was great. Some of the actual editing choices worked really well, like, along with the music. Like, I'm thinking of the scene, you know, the ending with Freebird, or the beginning with Rambling Man. You know, it was just like, it was night and day between the two movies. So that impressed me. You know, somebody who could make me say this is just a piece of shit to somebody who could say, okay, this is a decent movie, and whether or not it's supposed to be a ripoff or homage of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, it succeeds on its own as a movie.
Yeah. The thing is, and I don't really know many people that will sit there and say otherwise, Devil's Rejects is a better film. Even as a fan of House, Devil's Rejects is clearly a sign that he had better people around him that pointed out, hey, maybe do this instead. Like, it just was more coherent. He had a lot more star power. I mean, he had a lot of cool extra people like Brian Posehn, Lou Temple, DDP, Danny Trejo. It was just cool. Like, it was just a better story. And I will. One of the things I didn't like about House originally was the editing choice. It was almost like the horror variation of watching Man on Fire, because I hated how Man on Fire was edited, because it was a story that I liked, but I couldn't.
It's been so long since I've seen Man on Fire, I don't even really remember what you're referring to, but yeah, I mean, I remember Man on Fire had a decent story, but then I was just like, yeah, it almost falls apart as a movie because of the way it's being told, so.
Yeah, the technique, and I don't even know what the fuck this means, but the technique used for Man on Fire was called kinetic filmmaking. Even as a person that used to at least make movies and videos and shit, like, I still did. It was a poor decision. And that's where House of a Thousand Corpses is always going to be controversial in just the editing aspect, and how almost in your face it got at certain times when it really, subtlety would have been hugely important in certain areas.
Oh, like one of the, like I think the best kill scene in that whole movie, or maybe the two, were the two cops. You know, like when she just out of nowhere shoots the lieutenant, you know, right through his face, and then you have that scene where Otis is staring down with Walton Goggins, and they're just, you know, playing it out and playing it out and playing it out and playing it, and finally he shoots him. I mean, it's pretty much the plainest kills, but at the same time, you know, it wasn't like over the fucking top or, you know.
How do you feel about how long they held on to that scene though with Goggins?
I think
did they hold on too long?
No, I think that's what actually made it effective was the like the one thing I can say about the filming in the first movie. I was like, that scene was effective when I got done watching it.
I would say that's probably the most controversial scene among fans.
A second, I was like, did I fucking pause it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you're sitting there like, holy shit.
I'm watching
shit,
it on my phone. Like, I'm like, did I pause it? Did I hit the button?
I think for me, another thing is I liked the characters when we got to know the characters, when they weren't busy trying to scream in my fucking face and flash a bunch of lights in my face. The characters were good, but they really fleshed them out in Devil's Rejects, which, if you take away the character development of Captain Spaulding and Otis and Baby, that movie is ineffective as fuck. But because they spent the time to actually make those characters into something more, that's why there's people that are like, yay, go them at the end of Freebird. You know they're going to die, but you're still, there's a lot of people that still cheer them on at the end, myself included, because I'm invested, especially in Captain Spaulding and Otis. I can't help it. I mean, I still cheer on Jason Voorhees. I'm that guy. I just am.
All right, so remember never to invite you down to visit my family, Kent. So, no, like, I most of the time when I watch a horror movie, I can enjoy the bad guys, but I never root for the bad guys. You know, I'm pretty much always rooting for the good guys, because, you know, I guess that's what I see myself as. But, you know, they definitely did a job of making them characters rather than just caricatures, which is one of the problems I had with House. You know, House really just felt like somebody was shooting a fucking music video that went out for an hour and a half.
I was just going to say music video. Glad you said it. Yes, that's what it was. It felt like a long horror movie music video.
And, like, there were so many different things thrown in. It was just like, hey, let's see this, try this, see if it works. Whereas, you know, like I said, Devil's Rejects had a plot. You know, there was a beginning, a middle, and an ending. There was progression. There was, you know, character. There was storytelling. There was actual filmography. It was just overall a much better movie than House. And, like, House had some cool visuals. Like, I thought Dr. Satan looked cool. And he definitely looks like he was one of the motivations for one of the characters in the game Outlast that came out a couple of years ago. But
yes, good call. Yes. I haven't actually played that game for very long, but I 100% see where you're coming from with that. Dr. Satan. I felt that Dr. Satan's character, though, was lacking, and I feel it was 100% how they told the story. The whole final half hour just, I don't know, dragged down the film, quite frankly, for me. There were some cool parts, and then it ended in such a Texas Chainsaw Massacre way. I don't know, I felt that was kind of unnecessary to end it in a Texas, like, we get it, you're making an homage of some kind, but to end it that way, felt almost tacky.
Yeah, no, I agree. Did you see the trailer for the new Leatherface movie?
I have not.
It looks like it's the origin story of him as a child. Looks pretty good, actually.
And speaking of origin story, I don't want to really talk about these films, but did you see other Rob Zombie films?
No. I've never... I know that... he turned the Halloween basically and gave the origin of Michael, you know, with it. And from what I understand, that's where the people have the mixed contention over what he did to humanify him, rather than just leaving him as kind of this force, you know.
Yeah. You are pretty spot on with that. And the only reason I don't want to go too in depth in Halloween is because
you're going to be doing Halloween, yeah. So
yeah, I will say this. My mom got me into horror movies, and one of the earlier ones I remember was her showing me Halloween, and I always thought it was cool. And then as I grew up, I was like, it's cool, but they never gave us enough substance. So for me, when they provided, you know, 20 some odd minutes to substance on the character, for me, I prefer that. And normally I like mindless violence. Don't get me wrong. I really love mindless violence. But I loved actually having a rhyme and reason why this person acted this way. And yeah, that was a lightning rod for controversy. He also did the fucking witch movie. What was it? Salem?
Lords of Salem.
Salem, which underwhelmed me, but most witch movies do. And then he did 31, and God damn it, 31. I don't know. Maybe there are people out there that liked it. Maybe there are people out there that hasn't seen what I've seen that would make him as disappointed. We've talked about Get Out before, and one of the reasons I didn't like Get Out is because I've seen films so similar to that, there was nothing there for me. That's how I felt with 31. There was nothing there for me because I've seen so many movies like that. Plus, he devolved. He went right back to his House of Thousand Corpses editing style. Like, all the irritating shit from House, he just brought back for no real reason. It was insulting, really.
Yeah.
Very, very disappointed in him, and to the point where I don't know. Like, I'm starting to question, do I want another film from Rob Zombie?
Well,
I don't know.
I did bring it up in the blog, but I mean, I remember reading an interview with him, and one of the things that the interview viewer said, it was, you know, it's really hard to interview and get anything coherent from him because he is so stoned all the fucking time that it's hard for him to actually think coherently. So I think he's probably definitely a very visual thinker, and I think that, like, he's definitely got his own niche and his own, you know, if you've ever been to a Rob Zombie show, you know, like, his show he puts, it's a production. It's not just, you know, him up on stage singing or whatever. So I think that influences a lot of what he does, and maybe, you know, situation and circumstances just came together that when he was making Devil's Reject, he had enough people working with him that were able to either bypass that or direct it in the right direction. So,
oh yeah, I mean, one of the worst things you can do is just think you know it all. Like, the best stuff comes usually from people that get advice from a lot of other people, so they can weigh their choices and hopefully make the best decisions. And that's what Devil's Rejects felt like. That's what Halloween felt like. Part one, part two. That's a whole other thing. But yeah, same goes for a lot of these directors. I mean, hell, Spielberg. There are times where you're like, holy shit, did he just do this on his own without asking anybody for any... Like, it happens. It definitely happens. I'm trying to think. Didn't Rob Zombie have a hand in the quote-unquote psychedelic section of Beavis and Butthead?
He might.
Do America?
He might have.
I feel like he I don't know if he drew it or if he direct. I don't know. He was involved. I'm almost positive he was involved in just... It was only like a minute long scene, but it was kind of cool at the time if you were a fan of Beavis and Butthead. Which, I mean, that's something to kind of go like in a fucking time capsule. Like, looking back, it's beyond silly, but to my left, probably about 6 feet away, is a Beavis and Butthead gift set.
Hallucination scene, uncredited, he was.
Ah, so there we go. Man, what a unique time that was. But on the plus side, that was also back when MTV showed music videos way more than they showed TV shows.
Yes.
Something that I don't understand. I don't know. I'll never understand why MTV didn't just say, let's have a network for our TV shows and then have a network where we just played the videos. Like, they already had MTV 1 and 2. It never made sense to me why they just didn't keep MTV 1 for music videos, because that was the whole idea at the time. Always confused me. trying to think. We have... What do we have coming up? We have Dead Silence coming out.
And Housebound.
And Housebound. You've seen both of them, right?
I have not seen Housebound yet, so don't ruin it for me.
Okay. I will not. You may or may not enjoy it. I honestly, like, that one's one of those movies where I'm like, I don't know if people are going to like it nearly as much as I did. Like, there's bound to be, like, somebody that liked it as much as I did, but whether that's the majority or the minority, I have no idea. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. What else? Did Annabelle come out this past weekend, right?
Maybe.
I think so. I think it came out this past weekend. Didn't go see it. I'm okay with not having gone see it. It's coming out in, what, like 3 weeks, I think?
Pretty soon. From what I've been hearing, though, the majority of the reviews have been saying Annabelle was actually good. They said it blew away everything up to the original Conjuring in that series.
It looked better than the original from the trailers, but once again, trailers, people really still, like, there's some people out there that just don't get it. People, trailers are going to show, like, the best stuff of the whole movie. It's not indicative of how good the movie is. Frustrates me, because seriously, there are times where you're watching a trailer and you're like, if this is the best you have to offer me, I have zero interest. It happens. So, I don't know. Annabelle 2, hopefully it'll hit. It probably won't hit DVD, Blu-ray till January, I'm guessing.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of trailers for it. Looking forward to it. And I've been trying to keep track. This was supposed to be the year of horror, and then so many films got delayed or canceled entirely. So, like, it went from being, like, this great fucking revival of horror to... I know Friday the 13th got canceled. Tales from the Crypt on TNT got canceled. I don't know if you knew that that was a thing.
Yeah, I saw a trailer for it.
Yeah, I don't know. As of right now, I can't sit here and say that I've seen a lot from 2017. Have you seen much movies from 2017 in the horror?
No, but that's really, like, the ones... That's not ones I go see in the theater very often. So, We've had Alien Covenant, which just came out on video, which I'm looking forward to see. There's Get Out.
That's out now, right?
Yeah, it's out now. I want to say it came out like last week, maybe, on video.
All right, I got to order that.
There was Get Out, which was big earlier in the year, but like we've already talked about that. We got It coming out. Flatliners coming out. We'll have to see if that's any good, you know, remake of the original. Annabelle Creation is supposed to be pretty decent.
Mother looked good. Mother looks good. But, Chucky movie.
But it's hard to tell if Mother's going to be like horror movie or if it's just going to be a Darren Aronofsky movie, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not like Flatliners was really a horror, though, either.
Well, yeah.
But it was cool.
But I remember what they played it off on when they were advertising it versus what it actually was. You know, like... When the original one was in the advertisements, they were all talking about, you know, the fact that, like, oh, these things are coming back with them from when they go under. And you know, really, it was just fucking drama for the most part. It looks like it has the potential to be good. You know, we'll have to see. I saw a trailer for one that I found footage one that I actually thought looked intriguing coming out called The Monster Project. So we'll have to see how that goes. We've got Leatherface again. I just saw the trailer for that. That looked pretty good. So
there was something about it was a movie, it probably came out last month or maybe even before that. All I remember from the trailer was that like this family lived in like a cabin and they were told not to go out at night. Do you know what I'm talking about?
It Comes at Night.
Yeah, did you ever hear anything about it?
I heard it was shitty. They said basically it was like a fucking bottle drama about like not really even like a creature or anything, but like the situation where, like, it's post-apocalyptic time, what happens with, you know, like two families get stuck in close proximity, you know, kind of bullshit.
Oh, that bums me out significantly, to say the least, because I had kind of high hopes for that movie. I'll still watch it.
I like Joel Edgerton a lot, and he's made some pretty good choices in terms of movies that he's done, so... Yeah, again...
What do I know him from? I know the name.
Well, he was the main guy in that, but... he was in... You see Warrior with Tom Hardy?
Yeah.
He was his brother in that. He was... one of the dudes in King Arthur, the one with Clive Owen. He was in The Great Gatsby. He was in, I want to say, Black Mass.
Wow, you just named three straight movies I have not seen. But I can say that Warrior was very underrated.
Oh, that was fucking... That was right up there with... Oh, he was in The Gift. I'm pretty sure you saw that one, right?
Nope.
Wasn't that a fucking... Sam Raimi one? When we were listening? No.
Yeah,
he actually directed that shit. He directed it.
I never saw it, though. I think Dom talked about it, actually.
Yeah, it was fucked up. it was fucked up. He was in the... he's been in a lot of shit. Like, if you go on, you can just see a list of, like, a bunch of shit he's been in recently.
Yeah. Yeah, I, speaking of Dom, Dom's a great guy to talk to about films because, I mean, I don't know how long he worked in a video store, but that guy has a ton of movie knowledge.
He was the guy in the remake of The Thing.
Oh, okay. I begrudge that movie significantly, but I don't blame anybody that was in it. I just begrudge the writers.
Well, I mean, I think back to guys who made the original Thing in the 1950s are probably like, fuck that John Carpenter guy.
If that's true.
If they're still alive.
Which they probably aren't. The thing about The Thing... Alright, John Carpenter's is one of the most perfect horror films ever made. I'll argue that to my dying day. I think it's one of the most perfect films ever made.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
With that... Huh?
I'll definitely give it. It's probably top five creature features for me.
Yeah, like, it was just a really, really well done... And I can't call it strictly horror, because, I mean, it's sci-fi, monster... You know, it was a culmination of things. But it was just really well done. Not a lot of bullshit. And then when the... It's not a remake, it was a prequel. I don't know, it felt empty. And I'm often wondered, was that just because a movie was not going to be able to live up to the hype in my mind? Like, I just didn't want a prequel, quite frankly. I was happy knowing the beginning of the Carpenter's Thing. I was satisfied. I didn't need to know anything before that. So I was let down by the 2011 or whatever freaking year it was.
Yeah. Yeah, 2011.
Yeah, I don't know. Some movies, I just... sometimes I don't necessarily
I will
see
say
the
that that was the last year I went to Halloween Horror Nights at Orlando, and the Thing... house was actually pretty cool. So,
yeah, all you Florida fucks always tell me about this stuff. I'm always like, I want to go, and then I never can go. So, I'm blaming everybody that I know in Florida. I don't know why I know more people in Florida than I know in any other state, probably combined. But hey, glad to know that you guys have your cool Halloween horror nights. I'll someday come down, and hopefully, somebody will join me. Because they sound fun as hell.
It's basically... It's almost sad because I remember some of the ones that they put on, like, at the Moose, almost being as good as some of the houses. Well, not necessarily the houses, but there's like, spots. It's like if you go to Universal Studios theme park, and you're walking around, and they have all the areas in between where you're normally just walking, decorated up, and... People are out there in costumes and stuff, and then some of the buildings you go in are set up as haunted houses. The haunted houses, the three main ones that they do, which are usually based on movies, are usually pretty good because they're based on movies, and they're trying to get you to go see the movie as well as go, you know, to the theme park, so they have the budget for special effects. But the rest of them are usually kind of just okay, and that's what I was saying. Like, I remember the Moose, the one that they used to do in Johnstown, used to be pretty fucking scary, so.
I've never been to the Moose. For that, Although, now I don't know if I could handle it.
It shouldn't be that bad. I mean, at this point, we're adults. I mean, it's not like we're a kid anymore. I mean,
it's not the scare factory. It's, you know, a lot of these things have really loud noises, and that probably give me a headache and cause me to get dizzy. That's my fear. Like, I saw this thing. It apparently took place in Pennsylvania. And you could camp overnight, and they had, like, these five different things set up, like a zombie thing and, like, killer fucking clowns. And, like, you could participate. Like, they'd chase you around and stuff. And I was like, would that be fun? And would I, like, being actually in it, would I eventually, like, get out of that whole, like, mentality of too cool for school? Like, would I at some point be like, holy shit, this is kind of crazy? Or would I just be like, this is just a dude and a fucking clown? Like, I don't know. Like, I really wonder, would I get into that whole mentality or not? It sounded cool, though.
Yeah. I started to get, like, kind of skeptical about, like, these overnight campout things, or, like, some of these, you know, I want to say Orlando. Maybe Orlando, maybe it's them. One of the cities down here has this one where they had rent this building, right? And you go up a stairway on the outside, and then you have to go in the top of the building. So you go through this haunted house, and it's a big building. It's not like, you know, we're talking like, you know, just a couple rooms. It's, you know, three or four stories tall, but, you know, like a big office building. So you have to go through all of these rooms in the haunted house, and because you go in through the top, you can't, like, go out the side and go out. You have to go through the entire thing. So I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure, like, the house is October built, you know. Some other horror movies had setups like this. You know, I'm a survivor. I don't put myself in stupid situations in the first place.
Right. You have to question, like, at what point does everything around you take into mental effect versus you just being, like, logical and be like, this is a person getting paid $12 an hour to chase me around with a fucking toy axe or some shit.
I just think about accidents. Like, I did a haunted house back when I was in high school, right? And they gave me this fucking chainsaw. And they're like, okay, you're going to be the fucking Jason guy, right? So what they didn't tell me was, like, behind me was a fucking radio player with a fucking chainsaw noises on. So I fucking cranked the shit up in the middle of the fucking school. And I got the chainsaw going while people are coming through. And I'm trying to, all right, they're done. Like, how do I turn this off? I never fucking used a chainsaw before. I'm, like, only 15 years old. And I'm, like, trying to figure out how to turn it off in the dark because the lights are still off. And, like, you know, I'm like almost cut my fucking leg off. It was fucking probably scarier for me than it was for anybody else in the fucking haunted house.
That's awful, dude, and great.
And I guess if anybody from Johnstown School District is listening, and I'm going to fucking deny this to that day, but, you know, yeah, so anyways.
fantastic. Yeah. Oh, gosh. I always wanted to do the up in Lake George, the House of Frankenstein Wax Museum tour.
I went there. It was pretty cool.
I've heard nothing but great things. I've gone there twice, and both times something really weird has happened that's prevented it. Like, seriously, I've been up there, and the girl I was with, like, her car broke down one time. I can't even remember what the other thing was. Both times just completely cock-blocked me from going into it. Sucked. Oh, like, what was it? Was it, like, a full-fledged haunted house type setup?
Shit. I want to say it was almost kind of like the Captain Spaulding thing. I think it was, like, a ride. Okay. There's an actual, like, wax museum portion, and then you get down in, like, a cart or something, and you go through, like, this thing that... But, oh God, it's... I'd have been 8 or 9 the last time I was up there. I remember my aunt and uncle came up to visit from Long Island, and they took me and Jay for the weekend, and we went up to Lake George, and we camped out up there, and they took us to the Wax Museum as one of the things we did, you know, during the course of one of the days we were up there.
Nice. Nice. Well, at least I know somebody that's actually done it. That better than what I've done, unfortunately. All right. We should probably wrap this up, because once you get to the 2-hour mark, people just really start hating me. And we're a little over that. Do you have anything? We kind of did predictions, we kind of did everything, but do you have any final thoughts or anything else you want to talk about before we kill this thing?
Again, just like after the end of every episode we've seen so far this season, I'm fucking super psyched for next week.
Yeah, like, This weekend is WWE SummerSlam, which is like the second biggest pay-per-view event of the year, and for some jerk-off like me that watches wrestling religiously, I'm having a hard time because I know when 9 o'clock comes, I'm going to stop watching wrestling. And it's going to throw everything off, because when I go back to watch wrestling, I'm not going to be able to pick up where I left off, and it's going to be a mess. But I'm willing to forego that because Game of Thrones has been so freaking good.
The only thing I'll say, though, is, you know, a pay-per-view happens once at a time. You know, Game of Thrones, it's going to be out there for the rest of, you know, forever. You can... I mean, I have HBO Go in addition to just having HBO as a thing, so, you know, as soon as, like, 5 o'clock or the next morning rolls around, I can go and hit it up. Where, I mean, if you're paying for the pay-per-view, you might as well hit it. I'm not trying to talk you out of seeing it, but I'm trying to talk you out of seeing it because I'm not going to be able to do it on Monday, so...
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, I have HBO now, so I can watch it when it comes on at 9, and I can watch it, you know, anytime. But, I mean, once it's live, I can watch it. And I have the WWE Network. It's not like, you know, you remember back in the 90s, a pay-per-view would cost you $30-$40. Nowadays, it's $9.99 a month. You get whatever pay-per-views they do in that month, and that's it. Like, there's no extra bullshit.
Don't worry about it. Skip it. Go ahead.
Yep. I got Chris's permission to skip SummerSlam.
You heard that, Russ.
Oh, gosh. So, tomorrow, I do my podcast with Russ and Carrie, and because I lost a bet, I have to be nice the whole podcast and super positive. That's going to be hard for me.
Good luck.
Like, it's going to be really hard for me because you know how I am, so it should be an interesting time. Anything else? Any other thoughts before we wrap it up?
I think that's it for me.
All right, fantastic. Next week we'll come back for episode 6. We'll talk about, I don't know, we'll pick a movie beforehand and we'll kind of dissect it a little bit.
Oh.
That could be something different. Go on.
Yeah, I just, for some reason, I got in the mood to rewatch watch the Saw movies I had never seen, so I've actually started rewatching the whole series leading up to the release of Jigsaw. So if that's something you want to talk about, you know, that whole series.
Well, that's for mid-September. Because we're actually doing it. So September, just to let everybody know, not only on September 1st are we having The Housebound in Dead Silence, on September 2nd, which is 9 Dues, henceforth the fucking website and shit, we're doing Tales from the Hood. Then, mid-September, we are doing a Saw Marathon, and after that, I'm taking my 2-week hiatus before October hits, basically. So
what you're saying is I'm ahead of the game.
You are way ahead of the game. Maybe next week, do you have access to Tales from the Hood?
I do not. So we can work on that, because I know we've spoken about that in that blog. So.
Yep, I've got you taken care of, so we'll be fine. All right, so maybe next week we'll talk Game of Thrones and Tales from the Hood, because those two things go really well together somehow. All right, for Chris, this is Kent. And Sniffy Jerks later, thanks for listening. Go to 9deuce.com. I don't know. Like us, hate us, I don't know. Anyways, have a good night.